This is Community Voices with an event you may have missed, the UIS 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. As we get started, the Center for Lincoln Studies Executive Director Jake Freifeld will introduce the speakers, and we'll also hear from Chancellor Janet Gooch at UIS.
I'm the director of the Center for Lincoln Studies here at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Through research, our student opportunities, and public programs like this lecture, the center strives to share Lincoln's life and legacy with the world and ensure that everyone has a chance to see themselves reflected in Lincoln's legacy. This is always a special time of year. We get to gather together as a community and reflect on the life of Abraham Lincoln, the most famous Illinoisan, through a topic that was important in Lincoln's time and remains important to us today. As the Beaumont Lecture brings us together as a community, it also contributes to UIS's foundational goal of educating students. And that educational mission is even more important as we head into and try to navigate some uncertain times. And it's my pleasure and privilege each year to introduce our leader in that educational mission, UIS Chancellor Janet Gooch.
Thanks a lot, Jacob, and good evening to everyone. I'm really excited to welcome you to the UIS campus and to this year's Mary and James Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. It's a tongue twister. The annual Lincoln Legacy Lecture, first established in 2002, would not be possible without the generosity of Mary and the late James Beaumont. This support makes it possible for UIS to explore topics President Lincoln addressed that remain deeply relevant today. This lecture has become one of UIS's signature events, bringing together our university and our community. It continues to strengthen UIS's role as a national leader in the study of Abraham Lincoln's life and legacy, right here in his hometown of Springfield. We are truly fortunate to welcome Colleen Shogan, the 11th Archivist of the United States and the first woman to serve in this role, and Lincoln author Jason Emerson as this year's distinguished speakers. The theme of tonight's program, Lincoln and the Age of Disruption, is a timely one. In an era when our nation is again navigating political division and uncertainty, Lincoln's leadership offers lessons that continue to guide us. Recently, I had the privilege of sitting down with Jacob for my Chancellor's Thinker series, where we discussed Lincoln's enduring impact and relevance. If you missed that conversation, I encourage you to watch it on the UIS YouTube channel. During that conversation, we reflected on how Lincoln believed deeply in the power of public opinion, how he worked to bridge divides through civil processes and mutual respect, and how he continually sought common ground, even in the most divided times. Those lessons, including the importance of empathy, respect, compromise, and shared purpose, are timeless. They are just as vital today as they were more than 150 years ago. We are grateful for the Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series and the way it encourages all of us to learn from history, to draw insight from Lincoln's example, and to think critically about leadership, democracy, and human nature. I'm looking forward to hearing from our presenters tonight and to gaining new perspectives that will both challenge and inspire us. And now I turn it back over to Jake. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor. Last year, we gathered here hurtling towards a presidential election to listen to lectures on Lincoln and political conflict. Now that we've solved that, and there is no more political conflict in our country, but no, as I thought about this year's topic, Lincoln and the Age of Disruption seemed like a good fit. As he took office, our current president's opponents bemoaned how disruptive he was to our republic. Meanwhile, many of his supporters celebrated the president as a force of disruption in a Washington that needed to be disrupted. But of course, there are no completely smooth eras in American history. They all have their little disruptions. But no era in this country's history, not even ours, has experienced disruption like the 1850s and the war that followed, Lincoln's era. Abraham Lincoln responded to those disruptions by holding true to the principles and the Declaration of Independence and working to expand the circle of liberty in our country. Our first presenter, who I'm thankful didn't flinch at joining us all the way from New York on short notice, will discuss the period after the Civil War and addressed the question of whether Abraham Lincoln's son Robert, in his own leadership roles, lived up to his father's legacy amid the disruptions to Black Americans' civil rights. Our speaker is the author or editor of 8 books, including Giant in the Shadows, The Life of Robert T. Lincoln, and The Madness of Mary Lincoln. He is also a former park ranger right here in Springfield at the Lincoln Home National Historic Site. And it's my pleasure to introduce Jason Emerson.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad I could make it. I'm just flattered to be invited. I wanted to hew as close as possible to the theme tonight of the lecture series of Lincoln in the Age of Disruption, while also sticking to my areas of expertise, you know, Robert Lincoln, Mary Lincoln being the other one specifically. Although I do know a lot about Abraham because I did work here at the Lincoln Home. That's how I started in the world of Lincoln, by working as a park ranger, which is still one of my great, great life achievements, I'd say. And so I'd like to discuss with you, as Jake said, my thoughts on post-Civil War disruption in America, dominated as it was by civil rights for Black Americans, and how Robert T. Lincoln, the son of the great emancipator, and an important man in his own right, how he dealt with this issue in his roles as a civil servant, as a captain of industry, and even as a private citizen. And this is actually kind of timely for me because I recently wrote an article on a similar subject that, you know, when I was notified Monday, I was able to take this and turn it into a speech without too many sleepless nights. And there's been a lot of kind of a renewed output lately, I think, on how Abraham Lincoln's interactions with African Americans and how this aspect of his life informed his presidency and what he stood for and his ideals. But it's never really been looked at as to how this aspect of his life, what he thought about African Americans, how this impacted his children, especially his oldest son, Robert, who was 22 by the time his father died. Now, historians and Lincoln enthusiasts, they all love to hate Robert Lincoln. If any of you read any books on Lincoln, you know, everyone accuses him of being cold and haughty, aloof, an aristocrat, and all Todd and no Lincoln, as William Herndon liked to say. And actually, a common accusation is that Robert disliked, disrespected, and disregarded African Americans. There was one 2010 book called American History Revised that I saw, and it's about various oddities and incidents of American history that people don't know about. And there's a whole chapter just on Robert and how he was a racist, and he was a corporate tycoon, and he did not tolerate any dissent, and he loathed unions, and he socialized solely in lily-white segregated clubs, which was true, but I don't think there were any non-segregated clubs back then, but I could be wrong. Now, for those of you who may not know much about Robert's life, he was the oldest of the Lincoln's 4 boys and the only son to live to adulthood. He was a Chicago lawyer, ultimately one of the biggest lawyers in the Midwest. He was Secretary of War in the Garfield and Arthur administrations. He was Minister to Great Britain under President Benjamin Harrison. And by the 1890s, he had turned away from the law and turned more toward business. And he served as an officer or a board member on some of the biggest and most up-and-coming industries in America at the time, such as electric companies, telephone companies, automobile companies, banks, insurance companies, gas companies, and the biggest one of all, the Pullman Car Company, which Robert ultimately became president of and chairman of the board. And it was in these executive roles that Robert Lincoln was forced to confront the disruption and the division of race relations, often with national exposure to his actions. Now, Robert grew up seeing both sides of the racial divide. As a child in Springfield, he grew up in a town that had both free and enslaved blacks. Although the numbers weren't terribly large of those two groups, they were here. The Lincoln family interacted with black neighbors. They hired black help. Lincoln's barber, you know, Billy the Barber, was a black man who was also a good friend. There were black men and women throughout the town, and Lincoln even served some of them as an attorney in his law practice. Springfield residents who later reminisced about their connections with Lincoln and their experiences with him, they all agreed that Lincoln was fair and just to everybody, including black people, and he was really a racial egalitarian, as Michael Burlingame has described it. But Robert also saw the ugly side of this race relation divide, both in and out of Springfield. As a child, he saw the slave pens, the slave coffles in Washington when his father was a congressman in the 1840s. In Lexington, Kentucky, he saw the slave auctions in the streets when he went to visit the Todd home, not to mention the fact that the Todds themselves had slaves, usually an average of at least 5 in between the years of 1820 and 1850. And during his early years in Springfield, this was also the scene of some seizures of alleged fugitive slaves. They were taken in this town. Some were sent back into slavery. Some were let go. But after this, Robert went to New England, a completely different environment, than Midwest Illinois. From age 16 to 21, he went to Phillips Exeter Academy and then to Harvard College. And his experiences there greatly influenced his opinions on African Americans, and I think on society in general. You know, living in the center of abolitionism there, seeing free men on the streets, listening to learned men castigate slavery, having classmates from rich abolitionist New England backgrounds, you know, how could this not affect him in these formative years? Especially since it's clear that these years really affected every aspect of his personality when you look at his life, from the way he dressed, the way he spoke, his habits, his opinions, even the people that he surrounded himself with. And one reason his later detractors think that Robert was more Todd than Lincoln was because he had a more genteel sense of manners and refinement. And, you know, it's very often said he was a far cry from his backwoods father, which is certainly true. Now, of course, as a young man during the Civil War, Robert spoke with his father often at the White House, but he read his father's words. He saw his egalitarian actions regarding blacks. And for his entire life, Robert was very proud of that legacy. And this is how Robert was raised, in an environment where slavery existed. He was taught that blacks were people too, and that they shouldn't be slaves. But they were also inferior to whites. You know, when I was a park ranger here, one of my favorite things was to say, when Lincoln lived in this house, he did not think black people were equal to white people. And the kids would get so mad at me. I loved it. I'm like, well, you know, read about it. Don't take my word for it. And, you know, this was a typical belief of the time period, especially in the North, and for all the years of Robert's life. And this is an important context to remember as we discuss this. So, you know, once the war ended, Abraham Lincoln is dead. Robert became his own man. He had adult responsibilities, adult experiences. And this is where we see him really struggle with this disruptive issue of race in America. And I think we all know that the Reconstruction period did not as much as it could have to benefit the black race. And it was nothing like the post-war America that Abraham Lincoln had envisioned or hoped for. But instead, the black codes, the lynchings, the racism left these former slaves in a very trying social position. And Lincoln's hope for a new nation, I think, was only partly realized. Now, in this atmosphere, Robert Lincoln lived his adult life. And he was his own man, but he was also and always the only son, the only living son, of Abraham Lincoln. Now, his primary recorded associations with African Americans came during his tenures as Secretary of War and as President of the Pullman Company. And in the War Department, Secretary Lincoln confronted this thorny issue of race relations in the segregated army in the form of courts-martial and dismissals of black soldiers and West Point cadets. Not long after assuming his cabinet role, Robert dealt with the court-martial case of Lieutenant Henry O. Flipper and the expulsion of Johnson Whitaker from West Point. Flipper, who at the time in 1881 was the only black commissioned officer in the Army, he was accused of stealing money and embezzlement and conduct unbecoming an officer. He was found not guilty of the first charge, but guilty of the second, and subsequently he was dismissed from the service. Secretary Lincoln later said that Flipper's case was given greater consideration than if he had been a white man, precisely because he was the only black officer in the Army. But in the end, Lincoln decided that the record sustained his removal, and he told a newspaper reporter all talk of political influence being brought to bear in this case is mere chaff. Now, Whitaker was the only black cadet in the academy during most of his 4 years there, and in April 1880, he was attacked by his classmates. He was tied to a bed in his underwear, beaten and slashed, left bleeding on the floor. West Point administrators, very obviously, you know, sided with the white men that Whitaker accused of beating him. And they claimed, they felt, that he made the whole thing up just to gain sympathy because he was about to fail a philosophy class, which would have led to his expulsion anyways. So Whitaker was court-martialed, he was found guilty, and dismissed from the academy. President Chester A. Arthur actually overturned that conviction, ruling that the court-martial was illegal. But Secretary of War Lincoln, on the very same day, nevertheless, he discharged Whitaker from the academy, basically saying that the West Point board made their decision, and I'm going to stick with that. And they decided he failed the philosophy exam after getting beaten up, so he needed to be kicked out. And Robert later said that since he had assumed office, he had been constantly fighting the policies of favoritism at West Point, especially restoration and reappointments to cadets who had been dismissed. And he said that everybody learned very quickly that it was, quote, a waste of time to urge me to overturn the action of the board. Now, in at least one instance, Secretary Lincoln intervened to protect the rights of a black man to enlist in the military. In 1884, General William B. Hazen, commander of the U.S. Signal Service, he rejected the enlistment of a man named W. Hallett Green, the first black graduate of City College in New York, because Hazen claimed the law didn't allow it. It was illegal for a black man to enlist. Secretary Lincoln, when he heard of this, he overturned the decision. But more than that, he rebuked Hazen's logic and said there are numerous positions held by blacks in the army, in the government. There were even black congressmen. And Frank Leslie's Illustrated Journal, when they wrote about this, they applauded Robert for being, quote, truly his father's son. And this was something, as I said, Robert continually dealt with his entire life. If you can imagine, constantly being compared to your father and trying to uphold his example while also being your own person. Now, about 10 years after his cabinet position, Robert Lincoln became the general counsel to the Pullman Company, which I know is something a lot of us love around here in Illinois because it's right up there by Chicago. And Robert had actually been connected with George Pullman since the 1870s. He did legal work in the state, both for Pullman, the company, and Pullman, the man. And eventually, they actually became quite good personal friends. When Robert joined the company in 1894, it was just before the infamous Pullman strike up in Chicago.
The Age of Disruption. More about Robert Todd Lincoln and the Pullman strike from the 2025 UIS Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. After this, on 91.9 UIS. This is Community Voices with an event you may have missed. The UIS 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. Lincoln author Jason Emerson continues sharing the pressure of expectation on Abe's son after the Civil War and his work with the Pullman Company in Chicago.
What's interesting, what I learned as I wrote about Robert's life, was that Robert was actually George Pullman's personal attorney during this time. He was not the company attorney. There was a different attorney who dealt with all of the strike issues. And so Robert really didn't have much to do with the strike itself, at least nothing that's on paper. But when George Pullman got pulled into court after the strike, Robert helped him deal with that and prepare for that. But 3 years later, when George Pullman died, the company went to Robert T. Lincoln to be the new president. And he continued Pullman's tradition in many areas. He actually grew the business exponentially under his leadership. Now, he certainly wasn't perfect. And after the turn of the century, he found himself in the midst of both racial and labor issues involving the company's sleeping car porters. And these ultimately made national headlines. Now, George Pullman, for those of you who may not know, he began hiring freedmen as soon as the Civil War was over. And he recognized in them a huge and very valuable labor pool. And he also believed that ex-slaves, due to their previous roles in servitude, were very servile, and they'd be really great people to serve the white people who traveled in his cars. Now, black porters assisted the passengers in their general care and comfort, took care of their luggage, shined their shoes, brushed out their clothes, turned down their beds. Basically, anything a customer needed, the porters would take care of. And for former slaves, this was a very prestigious job, and it paid them more money than they had ever thought possible, and they got to travel across the country. The porter's friendly, smiling, and conscientious service was a hallmark of the Pullman Company. And if you go online and look, you can see some incredibly racially offensive posters of the time of the smiling black porters saying, come ride a Pullman. You know, it's the best ride you'll ever have. And, you know, George Pullman often said he never would have been as successful as he was without the Pullman porters to take care of the customers. Now, by the end of the 19th century, however, porters were no longer ex-slaves. They were the children of slaves. They had grown up free. They had education. They knew the value of their work, and they were not ready to work for a pittance and to have their labor be exploited. This new generation of African Americans saw their labor as a commodity, not to just be given away. And so here and there throughout the company, porters, after decades of watching white railroad workers do labor strikes, get paid higher wages, have their hours reduced, the porters decided that they needed the same thing. know, back then they were paid a very small salary between $25 and $50 a month at the turn of the century. But this was supplemented by tips from the passengers. And like, you know, food service workers today, you need those tips to make a decent living because your salary is low. And you also have to silently endure a lot of degrading torment from people who think they can do that because you're just a service worker. But the porters, besides that, they also worked shifts of anywhere from 12 to 36 hours without a break. If they fell asleep, if they lagged in their work, if they were not crisp and ready at every moment, they were fired on the spot because they failed to uphold the Pullman standard, it was called. Now, the company also required porters to take their small pay and buy all their own supplies, such as their shoeshine equipment, and that came out of their monthly pay. And so the porter's plight really got national attention for the first time, more or less, in 1904, after a 46-page pamphlet was published called Free Men Yet Slaves Under Abe Lincoln's Son, or Service and Wages of the Pullman Porters. Now, the booklet, which was circulated around the country, was written by a former porter, and he had been fired ostensibly for poor performance, but really because he was trying to unionize. And unionization was something that George Pullman absolutely abhorred, would not tolerate, and stamped out immediately. And Robert Lincoln, when he took over, he felt and he acted the same way. Now, the writer of this pamphlet, C.F. Anderson, he appealed his dismissal up the chain. Nothing happened. So he wrote directly to President Robert T. Lincoln and tried to lay out everything. And basically he said, yes, I sent pamphlets around the country because I wanted us all to talk about how we could get better wages, but I didn't want to unionize. And the only reason I got fired was because my supervisor didn't like me. And President Lincoln had his secretary write a response. And basically he said, President Lincoln has looked over all of your paperwork and he looked over everything. And he said that your removal has been justified by the record. And so thanks, but no thanks. You're not going to get rehired. And Anderson was so incensed by this response, by the fact that Lincoln couldn't even deign to sign his name, his secretary signed the letter, that that's when he sent this pamphlet out to the entire country and to the newspapers and made this a public issue. So Free Men Yet Slaves detailed the wages and working conditions of Pullman porters, and it contrasted that with the pay and hours of the white Pullman employees, the conductors, the managers, the superintendents. Quote, the Pullman Company regards the 6,000 or more porters now in the service as so many slaves to be used in whatever way they can be made to bring the company the most money, he wrote. He also called out President Robert Lincoln for what he called his blood money salary of $50,000 a year, which today would be about $1.6 million, while he refused to lift a finger to improve the lives of the porters or redress any of their grievances. And he said the porters would have to work 150 years to accumulate what Lincoln made in 1 year. The situation that confronted your father was chattel slavery, Anderson admonished. The thing that confronts you now is industrial slavery, which is even worse in some respects than was the former. Interestingly, I was unable to find any kind of response from Robert Lincoln to that letter, to this pamphlet, to the national attention. And Free Men Yet Slaves was published actually not long after another controversy involving African-American workers in the Pullman Company, beginning in about 1900 and hitting a crescendo really in about 1903. The Southern states passed a series of Jim Crow laws segregating Pullman cars, so black people could not even enter a car where white people were in. And black leaders like Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, they worked really hard to prevent and overturn these laws in the South. Washington actually wrote multiple letters to Robert Lincoln, and he asked him to support their efforts and protest these laws and desegregate the Pullman cars. Robert Lincoln actually refused all of these entreaties, saying it would really do more harm than good for him to meet with black leaders. And this is because Robert was a businessman, and he was an astute businessman, and he knew the likely racist backlash that would occur if the Pullman Company suddenly decided to support black workers and desegregate the cars. He knew a boycott would be bad for business. As the New York Times editorialized at the time, said, so long as the compulsion of desegregation was exercised, Pullman would practically have to give up their service in the Southern states. The whites would abandon it and the Negroes would not support it. And in his business dealings, we find this divergence between father and son. Robert Lincoln put profits ahead of people at Pullman Company, whereas his father, who met with hundreds of African Americans in the White House during the years 1862 to 1865, despite the negative political fallout, he put principle first. And in fact, in 1904, Booker T. Washington wrote, he wrote to the newspapers, he said that he felt Robert Lincoln was largely to blame for the segregation of the Pullman sleeping cars. He said, if Lincoln would just stand up straight, there would be little trouble. George Pullman let the world understand that no discrimination would be tolerated. Consequently, there was no trouble while he lived. And the Pullman Company's troubles with its black employees didn't end there. 11 years later, in 1915, the issue of pay and working conditions came up again. But this time, not just in the newspapers, Congress got involved, and they called hearings. And one of their star witnesses was Pullman Chairman of the Board, Robert T. Lincoln, age 72 at this time. So Lincoln testified before the Federal Commission on Industrial Relations. And it's really fascinating. If you look up the old newspapers, it's all in there. And he said, yeah, the tipping system is unfair. And yeah, the porter's wages are too low. And he said, quote, it annoys me very much indeed. But this is how it's always been. This is how George did it. This is how I'm going to do it. He also defended the system by saying that the porters actually made more money because of the tips than they would if they actually increased their wages. And he said to increase wages, then they'd have to increase ticket prices. And so either way, the public would pay the price. And then probably they would certainly tip the porters less because they would know the porters were to blame for the increased ticket prices. And so, you know, Robert defended the company. And he said, the one large element that has done more to uplift the Negro is the service in the Pullman Company. But he also admitted that having this system in place saved the company about $2 million a year, which today would be about $30 million a year. Now, some newspapers lauded Lincoln for his testimony, saying, this is the first time we can ever remember that the head of a major company actually spoke the truth to Congress. The Chicago Defender, which was an African-American newspaper, they asked in this huge headline, will Robert T. Lincoln be the second emancipator? And they wondered whether he would create a change to improve the pay and conditions for the porters. Now, other newspapers called Robert a hard-hearted racist. His views were, you know, so much different than his illustrious father. One newspaper even reported that one of the commissioners on the panel asked Robert Lincoln how his father would feel about the pseudo-slavery of Pullman porters. And the paper wrote, Mr. Lincoln showed his disdain for the question by ignoring it. But interestingly, the Pullman Company made good on Robert's statements, and they actually increased the wages of the porters the next year in 1916. Although the racial friction didn't end, and ultimately it all led to the creation of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union. Now by 1926, these issues of pay and conditions happened again. I think we're seeing a theme here. And the Pullman Company responded by publishing its own pamphlet this time. It was called The Pullman Porter, The Benefits of His Racial Monopoly. And they explained that the porter's salaries had risen 141% in the last 10 years. Employment was steady. Porters made enough that they could buy their own houses. A lot of porters even owned stock in the company. And basically it said that Pullman prosperity has helped the black race to improve and thrive more than anything else in American history. And the pamphlet began by saying, it is a fitting coincidence that Robert T. Lincoln, the son of the great emancipator, should have been associated with the Pullman Company for so many decades. Black leader A. Philip Randolph, who was the man who actually created the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, he replied to the Pullman propaganda by calling it pathetic and an unhappy gesture to invoke the name of Lincoln. And he said something very similar, if you'll remember. He said, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves from economic exploitation as chattel slaves, whereas his son, Robert T. Lincoln, has lent his influence and name to the notorious exploitation of Negroes as Pullman slaves. Now, at this point in his life, Robert was only weeks away from death, which was in the summer of 1926. And so I've never seen any evidence that he knew about this controversy, that he knew that the company used his name and exploited his name for their PR purposes. I have to think he didn't, because if he did, that was something he never allowed. He never allowed people to trade on his name or exploit his father's name for him. And so I don't think that he knew about that. And towards the end of his life, his wife and his doctor, they wouldn't let him read the newspaper, and they kept really interesting, important things away from him because they didn't want him to get upset. He had high levels of anxiety, just like his mother and his grandfather did. So one of the last incidents relating to Robert and this issue of racial disruption concerns his father's legacy and the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922, which was Robert's last public appearance. Now, sociologist Barry Schwartz wrote in a wonderful book called Abraham Lincoln and the Forge of National Memory, which I highly recommend if you've never read it. And he talks about the dedication to the monument, and he calls it a moment of reunion and reconciliation between the North and the South, a moment when the sectional disruption of the Civil War finally ended, when it really, truly ended, and everyone became Americans. And we were all tied together by the Republican ribbon of Abraham Lincoln and his democratic ideals. Robert Lincoln was there. There are photos of it, of him walking up wearing the big stovepipe hat. And, his face is just beaming. He always said it was the greatest monument ever created in world history, he thought. Ironically, this event really didn't do anything to relieve racial tensions because the audience of 50,000 people was segregated. And the keynote address by Robert Moton, president of the Tuskegee Institute, was censored by the event committee as too radical when they learned that he was going to criticize the federal government for failing to protect the rights of African Americans as Abraham Lincoln would have done. Now, Robert had nothing to do with the logistics of the event, the content of the event. You know, they wanted him to, and he made very clear, he said, if you want me there, I will attend, and that's it. I'm not doing anything else. So it's unknown if he knew about the speech censoring or the segregated audience. I'm sure he did. I think that was pretty typical back then, the segregated audience, and I'm sure if he wanted to speak up about it, he could have, but we'll never know. But I think these examples offer interesting insights into the racial and the labor disruptions of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the small role played in them by Abraham Lincoln's son. And did he uphold his father's mantle in treating all people as equals? Or did he shame the name of Lincoln? How much should the country have expected of him? And this really was a quandary that he dealt with his entire life. How to act as his own man, yet be cognizant of his responsibility to uphold the Lincoln legacy. And how he dealt with protecting his father's legacy for 60 years. That could be its own talk. How he dealt with historians, with artists, with writers, with politicians, protecting his father's papers. Think about that. Every day for 60 years, he had to deal with that. But coming back to our topic, as Secretary of War, Robert Lincoln made decisions based on the record and not based on race or politics. While he was at Pullman, he did put profits above principle. And his refusal to desegregate the Pullman cars, I think, is really a stain on his reputation, especially by modern standards. But everything has to be understood in its own historical context. And he was a businessman. He was not a politician. And his duty was to the Pullman shareholders, not to a voting constituency. Now, whether Abraham Lincoln would have acted this way, the way Robert did, is an open question. But, we know that as a lawyer, Lincoln fought for whoever his client was and whatever their viewpoint was. We know he didn't free the slaves immediately, despite great political pressure, because he knew the public wouldn't go along with it. And perhaps in this way, Robert is a little bit more like his father than it seems at first blush. Perhaps not. I think it's an interesting question. But, we can never really know for certain how Robert felt about these issues, living in tumultuous times within the confines of his father's legacy. We can only speculate based on the best available evidence. But as one historian wrote about Robert Lincoln in 1926 for Robert's obituary, is a line that when I read it all these years ago writing the book, it's always stuck with me as really a great encapsulation. He simply said, "What a responsibility to live a life worthy of such a man." Thank you.
The challenges of being Abraham Lincoln's son after the Civil War. Lincoln author Jason Emerson at the 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. After the break, we'll hear questions from the audience. And Monday, we'll hear from the other speaker, 11th Archivist of the United States, Colleen Shogan, on 91.9 UIS. This is Community Voices on 91.9 UIS. I'm co-host Randy Eccles, and we have an event you may have missed. This is the 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series featuring Jason Emerson, who is a Lincoln author, former National Park Ranger here in Springfield at the Lincoln Home. Also, Colleen Shogan, who we will feature on Monday's Community Voices. She was the 11th Archivist of the United States. Here are some questions that came up from the audience that both speakers answered.
I was archivist myself. I was one of many archivists at the Illinois State Archives for 41 and a quarter years. I wanted to ask her whether or not there are signs of problems with maintaining the integrity and the independence of the archive so it should preserve history and not try to interpret it to either right or left.
I don't have a lot of day-to-day information about what goes on at the National Archives. I couldn't give you every blow-by-blow. You know, there have been some troubling accounts that have come out. You know, as soon as I left, when Secretary Rubio was brought in as the head of the National Archives, there was day-to-day political leadership that was put in place to run the day-to-day operations. Immediately, things like our civics education and a lot of our public outreach efforts were eliminated right out of the gate. Those people went in the first round of layoffs. They were gone. There is a lot of concern. When I was at the National Archives, and when I was also at the Library of Congress for many, many more years than I was at the National Archives, we took how we interacted on a day-to-day basis very seriously to act in a nonpartisan way. There would never have been any political messages that would have went out from leadership of those institutions. Unfortunately, a few weeks ago, the person running the National Archives day-to-day sent out an email blaming the Democrats for the shutdown to all staff at the National Archives. Something like that would have never happened, certainly when I was there, but any of my predecessors were there, because we viewed the institution very strongly as a place that did not take part in partisanship or day-to-day political decision-making. So we'll have to see. And there has been some other accounts too. Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill, who is from New Jersey, who's running for governor of New Jersey, she had her entire military record released by the National Archives when only certain elements should have been released. Obviously, that is not a public record because she is under 62 years from when she stopped her military service, but yet her whole record was released. The National Archives said it was a mistake, but it was her opponent who had asked for those records. So that's very concerning.
Yes, Dr. Shogan, I wanted to talk a little bit or ask a couple questions of you. First is about staffing levels currently at National Archives. I realize that many humanities agencies have lost huge numbers of their staff members. What are the current staffing levels like at NARA, and how does that endanger our resources that are there?
From what, once again, this is a little bit difficult to know, but it seems as though there was at least a 10% cut in the first round, and I'm not sure exactly how much further that's going to have to go, because a lot of it will be determined by what the actual end game is on the budget or the appropriations for this fiscal year. But when I was the archivist, I thought the National Archives didn't have enough people even when I was there, and I was advocating for a drastic increase in the National Archives budget over the course of about a decade, that we would grow the budget so many tens of millions of dollars every year for a decade to really get to the level where we needed to be. And so the idea that the National Archives is going in the opposite direction is very concerning, and you will see an impact on that. There's no way that you're not going to see an impact, because people that are serving people in the research rooms, when you come in and you're requesting records, it's not just the people that you're interfacing with, it's the people behind the scenes that are also helping figure out what pools you need and what boxes you need. And when there's going to be fewer people to be able to do that, there's going to be, longer wait times or reduced hours at those facilities, or the reduction of the number of facilities. There's over 40 archival facilities all across the United States. You have many in this general area between St. Louis and Kansas City. You have an actual large accumulation of National Archives facilities, and I can't believe that all of those will be maintained. Some are going to have to close.
Jason, you mentioned at least three different occasions when Robert Lincoln had a chance to overturn a removal or conviction of a black person, be it in the Army or at Pullman. Did you dig into any of those cases? And What's your take on those cases? Did he do the right thing, or did the evidence bear out what he found?
Yeah, yes, from what I could find, the War Department cases were a little easier. They were, a lot of those were in the newspapers, the trial records were in the newspapers, and it's easier to condone what he did there because, yeah, he was a delegator. Everything that he did in life, he was a delegator, and which makes sense. I mean, if you're president of the multi-million-dollar Pullman company, you're not going to know what's happening down in St. Louis. But at Secretary of War, yeah, he always looked over all of the paperwork, as far as I could tell, and made a decision. But he rarely overturned what his subordinates had done because he trusted them to do the right thing. That's not to say he didn't overturn things, but yeah, now at Pullman, that's a little different. You know, he was much older by then. He was a true captain of industry, and as he got older, he got a little less patient with people, I think. It seems pretty clear. But, you know, the case with the porter that I mentioned, you know, C.F. Anderson, you know, it's clear to me that he didn't really care about this guy. He got fired. The record is complete, as it should be, so I'm not going to dig into it. You know, I could see him saying, I don't have the time to dig into everything. He was definitely a man who throughout his whole life, if you look at how he dealt with his father's legacy, you know, Robert decided very early. He had a choice to make in about 1865, maybe 66. And he wrote about this a couple of times. He said, you know, I learned very early I could either live my own life or my life could be consumed with my father's legacy. And he chose to live his own life. And so, you know, he was invited constantly to speak, to become honorary member, to become an honorary president of something, to write something, but especially speaking. He never spoke anywhere. He only spoke at the Galesburg, Illinois, the celebration of the Lincoln-Douglas debate there. And I think that was his only public speech where he ever spoke about his father. And that was for that. But he always said, listen, I don't do anything, because if I do one, then I am duty bound to do them all. And I can't do them all. And so that was his, you know, that was kind of the way he lived his life, with the sense of duty. And so I think that, you know, if I look at one case, I have to look at every case, which is not to justify what he does or doesn't do. But, you know, again, I always, when I look at these cases, I try to, you know, put myself in the context of the time of, and it's very easy to blame him, you know, especially as Lincoln's son. You know, I don't think Abraham Lincoln would have done that. Maybe not, but Robert was not a politician. You know, he was a lawyer. He was a Secretary of War. He was a businessman. And so, yeah, as far as from what I could tell, I think that especially Secretary of War, the record sustained what he chose.
Hi. First, I wanted to say a thank you to Dr. Shogan. I'm a staff member at the Illinois State Archives here in Springfield. And just speaking, you know, generally, it's a tough time to be in this field. You know, Illinois is a little bit different than some other places. I feel fairly secure, but it's a scary time. So I just wanted to thank you for your advocacy for libraries and museums and archives. I actually had a question for Jason. I was curious if there was, especially with Springfield being Robert Lincoln's hometown and him being, you know, alive and kind of publicly active at the time, if he had any sort of at least public response, or if, you know, a private response even to the 1908 race riot that occurred here in Springfield, and if he had, you know, felt any sort of connection to that.
Good question. You know, actually, I never found any public or private writing that he ever said about the race riot, which I was surprised about. I've looked through almost every single letter in his letterpress books, but not every single one, so I may have missed one. I mean, there are 80 volumes. But yeah, I mean, you would think something that major he would have had an opinion on. So yeah, unfortunately, I never did.
Quick question for each of you. Jason, I know you've done a lot of research into Mary's writings. Has she had any comments about race relations or, you know, anything like that? And Dr. Shogan, just curious about your comments on what just recently happened in with the Eisenhower Library.
So Mary's comments on race, you know, I haven't found much other than the few letters that are pretty well known. You know, in the 1850s, she wrote a letter to her sister where she was complaining about the quality of Irish help here in Springfield. And she said, I always tell Mr. Lincoln, you know, if he ever dies, he will never find me outside the confines of a slave state. Basically because, you know, slaves are better than Irish girls. But yeah, there's really not too much. There's You know, one very laughable supposed reminiscence of how she felt about the Emancipation Proclamation, which I don't put any credence in that. That's from a newspaper from the 1920s, I think. And so, yeah, there's, you know, honestly, there's really not too much that I can recall off the top of my head. And right now I'm doing a new edition of her collected letters. And I've got over 350 letters that are not in the Turner book right now. But I haven't found anything that talks about race, honestly. I mean, mostly she talks about herself, quite frankly. But yeah, there really has not been much.
Okay, so the question was about what has happened recently at the Eisenhower Library, and if you haven't seen the news about this, the director of the Eisenhower Library, which is a National Archives library, his name is Todd Arrington, and he was fired right before the shutdown. I think on September 30th, he was let go from the National Archives. And, you know, Todd, I've known Todd for a long time. He was the National Park Service many, many years at NPS and ran various sites, and most recently ran the James Garfield site in Ohio, and did such a good job with that site. He turned, like, the James Garfield site, which is kind of probably you would imagine, even though Garfield was actually a really interesting person and had a lot of admirable qualities, not like the most famous president of the United States, and he actually turned that site into a very popular site and a visited site, and very popular on social media because he had a very dry wit about him and how he wrote about James Garfield and his legacy, which was respectful of the legacy, but was also kind of funny. And it became one of the most followed social media accounts of not only the National Park Service, but at the entire federal government. So when I got to hire someone for the Eisenhower Library, I thought, well, I mean, Todd Arrington would be a good person to bring on board because if he could do that for James Garfield, I bet he could definitely do it for Dwight Eisenhower. He's got a lot more to work with Eisenhower. And that was one of the places that I kind of thought, you know, could be, you know, reinvigorated. And because not everybody can get to Abilene, we could benefit from some robust social media presence around the Eisenhower Library. And from all I could tell, certainly during my tenure at the National Archives, he was doing a great job. He got the Eisenhower Library named as one of, like, the best destinations in Newsweek magazine and, you know, all kinds of things. And he was let go because he tussled, unfortunately, with really the Trump administration because there was a sword in the Eisenhower collection. And when collections are accessioned by either the Smithsonian or the National Archives or the Library of Congress, when they're accessioned, they become the property of the American people. They are the permanent property of the American people. So literally, the American people own the Declaration. You own all the items that are in the National Archives. You own everything that's in the Smithsonian. Those institutions are just there to hold them in trust for the American people and take care of them and provide access to them. And so the request came from the State Department that, you know, President Trump was traveling abroad to visit King Charles and for a state visit over in the UK, and he wanted to give Charles one of Eisenhower's swords as a gift. And Todd said, well, I can't do that. I mean, you just can't. It's accession. You can't give it away. And, you know, there was a little back and forth, and eventually there was a solution that presented itself, which was to have a replica, locate a replica of the sword, and that was what was given to the king. But I think that ruffled some feathers because, you know, he essentially said no. And this goes really to the heart of my lecture, so thank you for the question, which is why these institutions should not be politicized. And, you know, who was the head of the National Archives, I guess, the acting archivist, is Marco Rubio. So that came from the State Department, which he is also in charge of. And this is why you don't want political people in charge of cultural heritage, because then cultural heritage items get used for political ends. And Todd was unfortunately at the very end of that that chain of that receiving line and lost his position, which was really, really upsetting. And he's doing okay. I'm sure he's going to find another job, and everybody is rallying around him to help him with it. But once again, the real loser here are the American people, because he was doing a great job over there at Eisenhower.
Colleen Shogan, the 11th Archivist of the United States and speaker at the 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series, answering questions, making a point of the losses due to partisanship that the United States citizenry is suffering. We will hear her full comments and speech Monday on Community Voices as we feature the second part of this Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series on 91.9 UIS.